Good afternoon, everyone. It's Dr. Nigro again, our next episode of Psychology Unplugged. Again, a heartfelt thank you to all of our followers, both here in the United States and internationally. I enjoy doing this on a weekly basis. It's really fun, especially when I get to talk with you guys and you email or text or call, and I try to get back to as many people as possible. So if I haven't gotten back to you, please keep reaching out. And I always like when people give suggestions for topics. And it's somebody, like I said, somebody can answer real quickly, and others I figure, because I don't know how I could fill up, 20, 30 minutes a week on a specific topic, but it's not because I'm not interested. And one of the common questions that I guess I've received lately, but has been somewhat pervasive throughout doing the podcast, is how do you get somebody involved in the mental health system if you are not the one struggling? And I did an episode in the past, maybe a year or two ago, on help rejectors. And I would, I guess maybe this is part two, but I think it warrants a revisitation, because a common question that I get is, how do I get my brother into therapy? How do I get my sister into rehab? How do I get my mother, who's had this long-standing condition, to even go for a neuropsych eval? Or how do I get someone to take medications? And I don't have an easy answer for this. And I don't think that there is a one-size-fits-all model. I think for any individual entering or is reticent to enter the mental health system, I think it's important to explore the different possible reasons. One, I think, of the most common is probably denial. Denial because of the shame associated with mental health, and something that I have deliberately tried to convey throughout all of the episodes of the podcast is, removing the label of shame, the euphemistic scarlet, scarlet letter. This should not be a life where someone is defined by a condition that they are experiencing. But I think denial is a major factor why people are hesitant to see a therapist, see a psychologist, get a neuropsych eval, talk to their primary care, because of the shame associated with it. Because I think people tend to equate mental health or mental weakness, whether that's depression, anxiety, voices, psychosis, substance use, they equate it, I think, very much with weakness and being defective. And in a Western world that is incredibly competitive and highly industrialized, and there's access to things almost immediately, it kind of is almost ironic that why wouldn't you want to take the opportunity to engage with a practitioner, especially, that telehealth is so prevalent, and that leads to a lot more privacy. But other things I've heard from people is, like, when a clinician bills for whether it's a therapy service, a medication visit, a neuropsych eval, something's mailed to the house, if you have health insurance, called the explanation of benefits. So there's a hypersensitivity to say, well, yeah, you did see Dr. Nigro on this date, and if you're not sharing this with your spouse or your family, and they say, why did Blue Cross, what were we doing seeing him? So I think there, yes, we have HIPAA, and we have, you know, privacy factors and as much protection as possible, but I do think that that shame really inhibits people from entering mental health, as I was saying before, and I think denial, and you know I've used this analogy many times throughout the podcast about you know the carnival mirrors, you know, where we can distort you know what we really look like and laugh and make fun of ourselves. But, you know, that's only an altered version that doesn't really exist. And, you know, when I try talking so much and emphasizing and truly believe and have seen this and truly believe that there is hope with mental health, I want to just allude to an article that I read about countries where they have legalized euthanasia, and that I think is a topic in and of itself. And it was a brief article. I don't remember what source I read it from, but I was reading it, and a woman in a European country was told by her medical provider that you're beyond hope, and there's nothing more I could do for you. And what she was diagnosed with was high functioning autism and borderline personality. Now, to me, I sit back and it's like, geez, I've been doing this podcast for 3.5 years and there's nothing to do with me. But to have somebody say that and then plan, I think next month she's planning to be euthanized and it's legal in the country in which she resides. But that, I think, for me, is an awful, awful message to tell somebody you're beyond hope. You know, maybe I'm not the best provider. Maybe I can't help you, or I've exhausted all my options. But to basically tell somebody that you're beyond hope, and that is the precursor for someone to say, I don't want to live anymore. And again, that is a totally different topic in and of itself. You know, euthanasia that I think would be a great conversation, because I really think it enters in the world of religion and spirituality and existentialism and philosophy. But just hearing that was really, I think I went through a range of emotions of frustration and angst and pain and feeling sorry for this woman, because I mean, are people beyond hope? I don't believe so. I think some disorders are more difficult to treat than others, and sometimes the practitioner that you're with may not be the best fit. I am, as a diagnostician, I test for everything. That does not mean I specialize in the treatment of everything, and I accept that and admit that. And it's just, you know, I like treating the personality disorders. I can treat depression. I can treat OCD. I can treat a variety of things. But there's other things that I just, you know, there are people who are better at it than me. And, you know, Julie does meds. And sometimes, you know, she, you know, texts and contacts her colleagues, because, you know, we all kind of get stuck in this field, and it can be difficult. And what I try to tell people, at least those in Massachusetts, is, again, I'm one person, and I did this with somebody recently. I said, can you come in and meet with me. And it was incredibly productive, because the association of what mental health is, what a neuropsych eval is, what cognitive behavioral therapy is, really is, I think we've only started to scratch the surface. And there's a lot of fear. You know, when people ask, are you going to hook me up to electrodes? Are you going to shoot me full of needles? Are you going to put me in a machine? So there's so much, even though I do this for a living, I mean, there's so much that people don't know, and I think that fear can be paralyzing. And I think another, you know, possible reason for not wanting to get into treatment is ignorance is bliss. And another possible reason is people may feel that they're beyond hope. And in working in community mental health, as part of my practicums and my internship, as my postdoctoral fellow, and even at individuals that see occasionally now, who have been in the mental health system since a very young age. They may have been removed from their families at a young age for a variety of reasons. They may have sustained, and I'm generalizing here, but just for the sake of giving us an example to work on, they have been placed in multiple foster homes and have been abused sexually, have been exploited. They've been taken to therapists. They've been taken to this person. They've been put on this medication. And as they've gotten older, say they're sitting across from me and they're 35 years old, and I'm asking them all these questions, and I, you know, with the realization that they've been asked these questions throughout their entire life. And they are sitting across from me in as much pain as they were back when they were a child. And I completely understand someone saying, why do I want to go through this again? It doesn't work. It's really hard to argue with that logic. But what I have found, I think it's sometimes, I've mentioned this before, the goodness of fit model. I think a lot of times it's the skill set of the practitioner, whether that's a neuropsychologist, a med provider, a individual therapist, there's got to be a connection. There's got to be a connection before anybody is going to tell their story. And some stories can have a lot of shame, and some stories can have a lot of detail, and not every clinician is able to handle what it is someone may be disclosing to them. And that's a really important insight on that part of a clinician, because that's what's called countertransference. That's when the individual is reacting to whatever the person across from them is saying. Now, again, I always say I'm not that old, but I've seen enough people, and there's nothing somebody could tell me that would make me be like, oh geez. And that's a function of experience. It's a function of being healthily desensitized. And it also helps that my wife and my partner in our private practice and our colleagues, we are all in the same field, so we hear the same things, and we're able to bounce things off of each other, which is incredibly, not everybody has that, but it's very healthy, because when you are a provider in the field of mental health, self-care is incredibly important. But back to this whole thing of what do you do if someone you see is struggling? I mean, there are things like we have what's called like a Section 12. If someone is a danger to themselves or others, and I have done this where I've had to contact the police and the fire department and have somebody, you know, involuntarily hospitalized because they basically presented or were unable to convince me that they were a danger to themselves once they left the office. Sometimes this can be a very seamless process where the person's like, okay, fine, I'll go, I need it. Other times it can be incredibly adversarial and dangerous. And I remember running an inpatient facility during my doctoral program back in Chicago and running down Lakeshore Drive and chasing people because there's such a fear. And are inpatient facilities Ritz-Carltons? Absolutely not. They're there for stabilization, and a lot of people they're scared, and I can speak from this not as somebody who's been inpatient, but who's worked inpatient. I've seen this, so you know I respect and understand, I think, both perspectives, those of the individuals who are trying to get their husband, spouse, child, mother, father, whoever, into the mental health system. I can certainly respect the frustration and the angst. And I can also respect, you know, where somebody may be hesitant. But what I have found is when you make it a condition, when it becomes threatening, when it becomes punitive, your outcome is, you know, the success rate or the amelioration of symptoms is not very high, because if someone's going just because they're told to go, that's not good enough. And I've said this before, that the only reason people change is because they are uncomfortable. And a lot of times, you know, especially working with personality disorders, I spend a lot of time just building the relationship and building the trust and building the consistency, which is something that is crucial in working with borderline personality, even, you know, dependent personality. But personality in and of itself, again, if I just keep it to borderline, you know, building that relationship is crucial, maybe even before, you know, spending several weeks before you really start getting into the work. But, you know, dragging people in, it doesn't work. Dropping your kid off for an hour, then going to run some errands and coming back, if people think that works, that is not an answer. What is a kid supposed to do? What control does a 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12-year-old kid, they're going back into the same environment. And, you know, work with kids really has to be a family systems model. Still can be cognitive behavioral therapy, but a kid doesn't, you can't drop them off for an hour a week and expect them to change. Nothing's going to happen. So I think there are a lot of various reasons, and again, I'm speaking from the summation of the message that I've got from people, and the pain that they have, and the pain that whatever pathology of the individual that they are in relationship with, their spouse, their partner, their child, you know, they're in pain themselves, and they're often in the therapy, but you can't want it more than someone else. And sometimes you do have to allow someone to hit rock bottom. And that is easier said than done, because if you are a reasonable human being, who wants to see their child, or who wants to see their spouse, who wants to see their loved one in pain? And the pain of mental health can look sometimes very destructive. And, you know, the police departments, they have no idea what to do with this. I think we need to do a better job of educating and providing resources. But to speak to the defense of the police officer, they see somebody who may be high on PCP. They may see someone waving their arms, and their job is to just maintain safety. So, you know, nothing against police officers, but I think we need to do a better job of educating individuals about mental health and what to do in those situations. And I remember back in Chicago, we would call inpatient, and some of the officers were amazing. They were amazing at being able to de-escalate people. And, you know, it's a skill set. But, you know, forcing somebody into mental health rarely, I think education is crucial to a vast majority of other disciplines outside of ones in mental health. And like I said, the police have come a long way, schools, but there's more work that we need to do, because if you're not in this field, you're not going to understand it. And mental health in those crisis situations, when somebody may be actively psychotic, when somebody may be delusional, when someone's running down the street at 3 a.m. and they're naked, somebody, you know, could be, you know, have intermittent explosive disorder and be in a violent rage. You know, the whole job is, whether there's the police or whether it's inpatient, is to contain. But then where do we go from there? And sometimes these experiences can be incredibly traumatic for an individual, because their cognition is altered, their emotions are dysregulated. It's the aftermath. So factoring in, you know, when you get denial, you get shame, you get multiple experiences that have led to, it's almost like, you know, the analogy, like, okay, I love driving Fords, but every Ford I had broke. So it's like, how many Fords have you had? Well, I've had 15. Okay, do you think maybe is it Ford, or is it possible that you might try a different manufacturer? Same kind of thing with, in terms of just dismissing therapy in and of itself. is very similar. It might not just have been the right clinician. It might have been, and people sometimes feel if they get assigned a clinician that they can switch. And some people do better with males. Some people do better with females. Some people do better with older individuals, younger individuals. And if you're a person considering getting into mental health, you have every right to ask for those things. And then ask what someone's level of experience is. But I do see the frustration and wanted to dedicate this episode to the reality that, you know, there is still a lot of fear, a lot of unknown, a lot of uncertainty about what this whole process is. And I see what something is just as testing, like, what is this? What are you going to be doing to me? And therapy takes on a whole different nature in and of itself, because you're really telling somebody your most private, innermost thoughts, and that can be embarrassing, that can be shameful. But on the flip side, it can be incredibly liberating to unburden yourself from thoughts and emotions and behaviors, and yes, we can change the way we think, and if we change the way we think, we're eventually going to change the way we feel, all for the better. But you know, threatening is not going to work. People threaten, either you get help or I'm divorcing you. It we're humans. We say these things. Go to therapy or I'm not dating you. That doesn't work. Until you get to a level of discomfort. And, you know, interventions, you know, you talk, I just think about the Seinfeld episode about the interventions. I think when people point the spotlight on us that we are doing something wrong, independent of its mental health, or we are doing something, or we're making a mistake, automatically we shift into being defensive. You know, couples therapy 101, never start a statement with, "You make me feel." One, that's not a true statement because nobody can make anybody feel anything. But as soon as we hear the word "you," myself included, we automatically become defensive. Versus like, "Hey, you did a great job." That's a little different when it's you with the coming statements of, "You better, you need to." And in our culture, in our society, we don't like to be told that at all. You're going to tell a kid with oppositional defiant disorder or conduct disorder, "You need to sit down." Even a kid with ADHD, you tell them that? I mean, we have this automatic, I don't know if that's probably somewhat involved in the more the sociological fight or flight, but you know, our self-esteem is something that is very precious and is very fragile. And when it's questioned our sense of self is acting in a way that is causing problems, you know, that's when the defense mechanism kick up. That's when it becomes projection, denial, rationalization, simplification, justification. And, you know, that's, you know, if you go back to the episode I did on the irrational beliefs, the 17 irrational beliefs, outlined by Robert Leahy. I mean, we all do these, but I think in the struggles of getting people into the mental health system, these are the things that I think people in general are facing. And sometimes there are even like cultural issues. Say somebody is delusional and they're extremely psychotic and they have a strong religious belief and believe that God's telling me not to go. Then you get into a whole different kind of mindset of like, all right, how do I know that God isn't really telling this person? You know, am I a non-believer? But they're not causing any distress, but they're walking around, you know, preaching sermons. And I think then it gets into like an interesting conversation. Like, you know, does that person need to be put on an antipsychotic or do they need to be hospitalized? They're not causing any harm, but sometimes those, you know, cultural beliefs, that's what I say. If you ever get a chance, if you have a copy of the big DSM, and you go back in the back of the book and look at the cultural disorders, they're really kind of cool. You don't see them a lot. I've seen one or two, Not that common. And sometimes different nationalities, they have different perspectives on mental health, that things are all dealt with within the home. And I've worked with people who, you know, who broke away from the family system because they say, look, I don't agree with that. And you know, I need a more Western approach. And, you know, a Western approach is something that we are, you know, indoctrinated in. I think there's, you know, utility to meditation and mindfulness and Eastern philosophy, but I will always digress back to being a scientist practitioner in a Western mindset because I was trained in that and I see the efficacy of it and I see the utility of it and the benefits of it. But simply saying go to therapy, not going to work. Go to therapy or else, definitely not going to work. So then what do you do? Some people, you know, I tell people, you put it on the altar. And, you know, sometimes people have those aha moments. And sometimes it's almost like, can you just dip your toe in the water and experience it? And it's like, wow, that was way different than what I thought it was going to be. And, you know, it's also very helpful, like when I'm, you know, getting phone calls for, you know, grace of God for referrals, for evals, especially for kids, it's helpful for me to be asking about parents, like, are they open to this? Or maybe even if it's a wife calling for their husband or partner, whatever, are they open to this? You know, what's their experience? Is this their first time? What is their experience? What has it been? Because it helps me to be more prepared upon my initial conversation with the person, generally in person, of what to kind of expect. And, you know, I don't fit the typical mold of what people expect when they come to meet me. It's not an act that I put on. I'm just true and genuine to myself. But this is definitely a struggle that I think a lot of people deal with, and it can be incredibly frustrating when you see people that you love, you see people that you care about, you see people that really need help. And, you know, not that we're smarter or better than the other person, but say, look, you need to be seeing somebody and don't have the magical thinking like, well, it's just going to get better overnight. Stuff like depression and anxiety, I think people minimize that. And those things that can overtake you overnight. And it's frustrating when you see you have resources and you have therapists and you have prescribers and you have diagnosticians that are willing to help, and someone is not willing to take that route. Yes, that can be incredibly frustrating. And I think that's where it's important for you, if I'm talking to you as the person who's frustrated, to get into therapy, to talk to a professional, because it can be incredibly frustrating. It's like saying, you keep complaining that you're thirsty and here's a glass of water. Why won't you drink it? And they come up with 25 reasons, most of which are irrational, why they won't drink it. But you're saying you're thirsty. So it's like, stop complaining. But it's hard when it's someone you're close to, when it's someone you love. And then there's other people who, you know, have played the, I don't want to say game, but have dealt with family members who've been who have been involved with mental health for an extended period of time, and they've seen whether their children get arrested or have Narcan or be inpatient or in therapy or, you know, prematurely quit therapy, and this stuff takes its toll on you, because a lot of projection, especially when you get into the personality disorders, is blame. You know, it's your fault. You did this. You didn't do this, and you know that is an exercise in futility. But this is where a lot of people come from, because you know, I think there's that equation that it has that is almost an unfair synonymous correlation that there's something wrong with you. And as I've said multiple times throughout these podcasts, I tell people, whatever it is, it's something that you have. It is not something that you are. But you cannot want it more than the other individual. And this is the hard part. If someone, you know, I mentioned this probably on the help rejectors one. Sometimes you gotta love people from afar. And sometimes you gotta, if your own mental health is being compromised by it, sometimes you need to walk away and realize, unless you're just gonna be involved in this codependent relationship, and if you think you're helping, you might be, but you're also reinforcing it, because if you're there to take care of all the problems, why are they gonna change? If you're there to pick up whatever slack that they need because they need to pick up a shift or they need to do that, and you're running over, but they've called you every name in the book, how are you helping? If you really step back, how are you helping? You're not. You're just reinforcing the pathology. So it's a topic that I wanted to revisit because of I've talked to enough people, and there is no clear answer. Being supportive, trying to understand, you know, what their rationale for not doing it or not wanting to try to get into the mental health system. Medication is a whole different topic in and of itself, because people have their own beliefs about medication. That's a whole conversation in and of itself. I'm just simply talking about just entry into the mental health system, as opposed to say, you know what, I do need to kind of address that. But I can tell you that with the right treatment and the right diagnoses, obviously get a neuropsych eval, the right medication, it can be life-changing for the better, not only for the person who may be struggling with some form of psychopathology, but also for all the people that are involved and being impacted by it. Because generally, in my experience, it's not just one person that's being impacted, especially when you're dealing with children and teenagers and adolescents. But there is hope. There is definitely hope. Never lose sight of that. It's work. It does not happen overnight. But with the work, generally comes the outcomes that you're looking for. Julie?
No, I was just going to review and just add something. I'm sorry, I wasn't really sitting here for the entire podcast. I was doing some much-needed projects. First, I want to thank the people who started following us on Instagram. I think it was maybe around 1,000 of you. And I asked you to follow my stories and give us a follow. And I had tears in my eyes. I actually was I jumped off the couch and I was like, what? So if you can keep doing that, I'm so grateful, because we're getting the word out about a lot of things. I want to also kind of rein myself in a little bit. I think that my message is really the humane treatment of animals in general. But I think some of my posts have been probably a little more than most people want to look at this time. But, thank you so much for your patience and your interest and spreading the word. That aside, I do want to follow up with, working with people who are ready for treatment, are not ready for treatment, who think they're ready for treatment, and then once they're in treatment, they're like, oh, you know, especially those of, like Cora talked about, clients of ours who've been in the field of in mental health care for almost their whole lives. They kind of roll their eyes at therapy and starting new with someone. And, you know, it's not really, a lot of it has to do with a very high turnover rate in these agencies. A lot of the agencies are really the grind. And a lot of people, you know, start out there and they continue working there. They pay more money. The demand is very high to see as many patients as possible. Therefore, the burnout rate is very high. Therefore, the turnover rate is very high. I've seen this probably in, 60% of the patients I've seen overall. Clinicians leave, for other reasons. Some go on maternity leave, some get a job somewhere else. I've seen that all play out in so many of my clients' lives over the years. And it's really hard for people to go from one therapist to another. It's a very vulnerable relationship, especially, if you have a really good connection and you've made a lot of progress, it can be utterly nerve-wracking to start at the beginning of therapy with somebody else. So sometimes people will drop out of treatment and give up. You know, when people think they need treatment or know they need treatment and they start treatment too as well and maybe are not as familiar with working in therapy, sometimes once, you know, the first few visits is really just about gathering history and getting, it's like kind of business. But once you start get delving into your history, what I notice and what I notice when I'm working with collaborative therapists with my clients is that, you know, people's anxiety will go up when they're doing work and when they're doing, you know, work on themselves, when they go back into their, you know, family of origin issues or traumatic issues. You know, the anxiety goes up and sometimes they're not really sure why they're anxious. But then when we start to talk about what's going on in therapy, how's that going? They'll say, oh, well, you know, we're really talking a lot about my relationship with my mom, or my relationship, you know, with my abuser, or, you know, the bullying that I've endured growing up, or, you know, all kinds of things that, you know, things that to that specific person or individual are very difficult to discuss. So, you know, you can't lead a horse to water if they don't want to drink, right? You can't get water from a rock. I know these are cliches, but it's definitely true. You can want something, and I know this more than anybody. For a lot of my clients, I want things more than sometimes they do, and that is definitely an internal antenna for me, because it makes me kind of pull myself back, because I'm not really helping if I'm kind of coercing. And you know, sometimes people just aren't ready, and sometimes they have to fall down a few times before they're ready. And sometimes people in their families are the identified patient and they have dysfunctional families, but this one, you know, individual in the family is the one that there's scapegoat with all the issues and problems for various reasons. And it's really more individuals in the family that need help just as much as this identified patient. So I've seen a lot of that as well. And in terms of that euthanasia, I can't even comprehend that. I find it quite unconscionable, but I feel like I don't want to talk about hospice really, but I do, I don't want to speak to this much, but I do know that when someone is dying in hospice, and they're in a lot of pain, I think it's pretty well known that sometimes they increase the pain medicine. And again, I'm not saying that happens all the time. I'm just saying that that's sort of been my experience. That is with a person who's dying and who is consented to that. I have never heard of anybody. Look, there are a lot of people that, you know, in our business, it's a fit thing. You know, sometimes people meet with people and it's just like right off the bat, it's not a good fit. And then there are the people used to that vibe with therapists, and then they fire therapists a lot, which that also isn't good, because there's something to be said for it. You can't repeatedly fire everybody and move on to the next one until you find that comfort level. And that usually comes down to hearing what you want to hear, or validation is crucial, but someone who's not really helping you grow. There are some therapists who have very different ways about it. And again, it's not a critique, but back to the euthanasia and mental health, I can't even imagine, you know, we can have frustrating relationships with our clients at times. And I think that that can be very normal depending on the client. The goal would be is to work through it. The goal would be is to say, hey, you know, if these meds aren't working for you, or if this isn't working, I have a colleague that if you want another pair of eyes. All of us are like that, our colleagues. You know, you're never alone in this business. And if you're alone and you think you can do everything all by yourself without the, you know, advice of your colleagues, then you're arrogant. And arrogance is very dangerous in this field. So coming back to the euthanasia, I can't even possibly imagine what that person must have felt when a doctor. And again, this is an article that was written. I don't want to get into who and what and where, but to have a mental health professional say that to somebody with really truly meaning that is saying you don't matter. And I couldn't help but remember when for those of us who have had pets who get sick and they're not fixable, how many of us, and I've had several, how many of us have needed that vet to say it's time, because it's so hard to make that call, because you don't feel comfortable making that call, because of course it's a loved one, but at the same time it's like, do I have a right to make this call? So we rely on medical professionals, but when it comes to medical health and whether or not something is going to survive or not. And I think that was the one thing that really stuck for me. And I felt terribly hurt for this woman who experienced this. And again, I wasn't there. I don't know what was said, but to actually have a healthcare professional say, yeah, you know, there's no hope for you because of your personality. And there's nothing we can do. And even if that provider was fed up, which some providers can be, some clients are extremely difficult and hard to please. Help rejectors. I still can't imagine saying that to somebody. If this is the case in any professional relationship with a client, you very often will talk to that client about, listen, I get it. You're frustrated. I get it. How can I help you moving forward? I know someone else who also does this. Maybe you might want to, you know, check in with that person and have an intake with that person and see how you feel. Very often people will come back or they won't. Maybe they'll like that new person. You know, it's a better fit. You know, it's personality, it's chemistry. But sometimes people come back because if they hear that same person telling them the same thing, then it's like, oh, okay, you know. But that's just getting a second opinion. And there is nothing wrong with doing that. In fact, I encourage it if anyone's on the fence about it. I think it's important to always get a second opinion if it's available. So I just wanted to say thank you. I'm going to wrap up. I don't want to go on and on, but I hopefully my points are made clear. We love the phone calls. We love the emails. We love the texts. We love talking about this stuff and helping people to, you know, educate them. Like, we're not treating anybody out there, but, you know, to help with the educational piece and to help people feel less alone. I believe there is hope for anyone, as long as they want help. And thank you again for your following our Instagram. It means the world to me because I'm trying to do something for helpless animals. And, I really, really am grateful for that. I'm getting choked up right now. So God bless you guys. Thank you for following and listening to us. And we'll talk to you next week.
Thank you, Julie. No, it's good. Well, all right. So hopefully this was helpful and impactful and resonates with a lot of people because it is definitely a viable topic and something that I know a lot of you are experiencing from both sides of this paradigm. But until next week, feel free to reach out to me through Psychology Unplugged, through Psychology Today. You can email me directly at psychologyunplugged@outlook.com. You could follow us on Instagram at psychology_unplugged_. And you can even contact me directly, 617-750-9411, East Coast Standard Time in the United States. Until next time, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, be well, and I will talk to you guys. Bye.